And then next week we have the Imam, Imam Yama Niyazi from the Islamic Society of Santa Barbara, talking about compassion and the Islamic view. So with that, Father Jim is on. He's on. All right.
Okay, if I could start, I've already got a couple questions over the table, so I'll start with those two. First off was to explain a bit more about the CDs. I was asked by Now You Know Media to give a series of 12 talks in the field of spirituality, which is my expertise. And this is a Catholic company that the founder is a guy named Michael Bloom. He was one of the co-founders of the very famous, Great Stories on Tape, or CDs. Anyways, he wanted to take that expertise and found a new company based on his experience, but to bring that to Catholics. And so what they've been doing the last several years is connecting with scripture scholars, church historians, theologians, but they recognized that they did not have much in spirituality. So my name was recommended, and so I put it together specifically for them. And this is an accumulation of my 30-plus years of working in this field. Much like the way I present here, I must admit it's intense and it's dense, but that's what they want. And they're only 25 minutes. So there's three talks in each CD. They said, can we do the DVD? I said, sure. So it's the same thing, you just see me. But it's not a talking head. They have wonderful experts that brought in nature and all that stuff. But it's put together for not only individuals, but for groups. There's also a CD you put in the computer that has an outline of every talk with reflection questions and further reading. You want to do that on your own. So that's what that's all about. Our reviews so far have been pretty good, so I'm grateful for that. The other question, and I definitely agree, is that let's go back to grief. As Americans, we don't grieve well. A lot of it has to do with we're trained to be a fix-it people. If something's wrong, we fix it. Grief is not about being fixed. And so often, especially for us men, we can come at it that way. You know, it's like, okay, well, it's been 30 days, it should be over this. It's like, well, depending upon what it is, you can't force it. There are some ways of grieving well. Then there are ways that we can grieve poorly. So I want to be clear that, in effect, if we reframe the language, these are steps of moving through the grieving process. And every grief is unique. No two griefs are the same. Even if you meet another widower just like you, his grief is different. Okay? Different relationship, different age, different story, etc. Even if you've lost a pet and you've met somebody else, it's not the same. So to say, I know just how you feel, demeans the other person. When I lost my parents within 3 weeks of each other, I got that a few times. And I just had to smile because I knew, being mindful of the situation, I knew it wasn't about me, it was about them. That was their way of trying to push it at bay. And a lot of people don't know how to respond in the face of pain or suffering. And so they try and put it away. Even my sister-in-law, I can't believe she did this, said this to my sister. And thank God Virginia had self-control. We were celebrating a home Eucharist. And it was had the family there to honor my parents. She turned to my sister and said, well, at least your parents went together close. I had to struggle on for many, many years. It was like completely dismissed Virginia's grief. You see? So grief is personal. Grief grows through stages. And we honor the steps. But in the way of sharing, what I mean by sharing is that at some level, according to your capability and willingness, you are invited to share that. That doesn't mean that, let me tell you what I learned from that, unless you're invited to do that. Does that make sense? Because it opens up the channels. This is why, for example, bereavement groups can be helpful. But if you come across as the master, and the other person is a student, not good. Not good. Timing is everything. So those are two questions that came up. Anything else? Disagreements? Reflections? Here comes Don. Yeah. One of my former professors from Pacifica.
By no means disagreement or problems. What I want to do in this question is mine some of your current experience. Mm-hmm. And so, as you were going along, one of the things that occurred to me is, you know, what if we stayed with our reality, whether it's painful or not, in the way that Francis has talked about the church? And then I thought, oh, but that's a good question to ask, to ask you. And it's like this. Francis is saying, among other things, we've had our attention on the wrong thing. We've looked at some things very narrowly and very intensely and as a litmus test, and they're not even the big questions. Yes. So some part of my question is to ask how this has been, like, in your life there in the seminary. You're in the seminary still, mm-hmm.
Yes.
In terms of the excitement around this that I'm picking up in the media,
mm-hmm.
but I have no close connection with either a parish
yes.
or with a seminary, even
yes.
more so.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering how this is, you know, faring. How is this working there?
Thank you, Don. It's working well. I mean, especially because part of it is being young males, but the other part, I think, is just the way that our histories unfold, in that the majority of the seminarians are there because they were attracted to either like a particular priest and his ministry, or they got involved in, like, say, parish ministry, or attracted a certain pope. For example, we still have vestiges of the effects of John Paul II, of guys who are attracted to that type of demeanor. Okay, and yes, Benedict as well, Benedict XVI. So it's still too new. Francis is too new as a pope, but we haven't had anyone come because of his fervor and his way of looking at life. But having said all that, what he's saying and what he's doing is generating a lot of excitement and activity. I'll be honest with you, more amongst faculty than students. but the students are excited by his openness. And they're also intrigued by his comments, because, you know, this is now the full generation of social media. So they're constantly online, and they're getting stuff quicker than we are, because some of us are still doing the old way of researching. But it's like, did you hear about it? It's like, oh, no, let me check. So, yes, a lot of excitement. It comes in the classroom. It comes with the questions and comments. What I'm grateful for is the guys seem to be much more relaxed about liturgy. We're under Benedict. They're this type of thing. So, and that also helps because our own Archbishop Gomez made a joke of it at the last Cathedral Assembly when he said, you know I've heard some questions about what am I going to do when you guys don't follow what we've been told to change. He goes, he laughed and he says, you guys are going to do whatever you want, I know that. And we all laughed and went on to the next thing. So there's more of a, especially with Francis there at the helm, it's more of a relaxed approach to life and ministry. Now in fairness, because I talked about shadow work, there are obviously some things that are missing that Francis, for whatever reason, is not willing to address. Okay? One is women. Okay? His language is really limited. He seems to use woman and mother in the same sentence all the time. Okay? He had another one, machismo, and that he's referring to the feminist theologians. Okay? So that's a glaring weakness. Okay? The other one is he's been saying and doing all the right things, but at least right now there's been no lasting change. So if you think about it, no change in doctrine, no change in hierarchical status, no change in anything that's lasting. So this next month will really point out where he's going, because the governance council, remember, that's made up of the seven cardinals, one from each area of the world, each continent in effect, obviously not Antarctica, but he's divided up in such a way with his representative from each area. They have been supposedly behind the scenes furiously dialoguing stuff. So in October, they're supposed to come up with a list of changes to the Roman Curia. Why is it so important? Every pope is elected with one major job to do. For example, John Paul II was elected to be able to deal with the communist threat in Europe. Okay, he did it. And I shouldn't say it that way. I've changed my word. He did it. But after he was done, which was already on his papacy, it was like, okay, he was like a bull in a china shop. What am I supposed to do now? Okay. So Francis was elected, and the mandate was clean up the Roman Curia. So he chose a Secretary of State that appears to be, by all signs, a really good choice. So we're looking for some possible changes in that regard. Now, his choices about what he's going to do in change in Roman Curia is going to send a real clear call to where the rest of his papacy is going to be like. Because, at least behind the scenes, it's going to mean getting some of the, how should we say, the old conservative, lifelong folks in there out. And as John the 23rd said when he was asked, well, how many people do work in the Curia? Only about a half. So, if nothing else, if he streamlines it, for example, and if he does some major changing with the way that the Vatican does their banking, that would be major. Okay. So the doctrine, he hasn't really addressed that, and the whole idea of about women. And the third one is women religious. You know, every woman I talk to that I appreciate and admire in the church, they all say, yeah, but, and they always point to, he hasn't in any way stepped forward to tell the bishops to shut up and let these women do their work. And so those are three that I think he's missing right now. But we've got to give the guy some more space, because what we don't realize is a man like him, much like John the 23rd, is he has to hold back the strong conservative pushback. And so we need to hope and pray that he has enough support and encouragement that he's faithful to what he feels God's calling him to do. Okay, so. And his Jesuit brothers will keep him in line too. So thank you, John, for letting me speak to that. Anything else?
You mentioned it briefly when you were speaking about rituals, and I know rituals are important to you. I wonder if you might share some example of a ritual, and maybe in the context of what you addressed today.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Rituals are very important to me on many levels, both personally in our family. We found them to be very helpful. They, for us as a family, and for me personally, they were like markers and handholds to help us through different grief experiences in our life. And so, yes, they're very important. Let's see if I can think of one in regards to compassion. I can share in an audience like this. I can't share in too many audiences. I think it was about 2, maybe 3 years into the pre-scandal. My role, one of the other things I do is I spend Mondays at the House of Prayer, Cardinal Manning House of Prayer for priests in Los Angeles, giving spiritual direction and hearing the confessions of priests. Not just L.A. Diocese, but around. And part of that also, I work with the Vicar for Clergy's office sometimes in some challenging cases, as we call them. And so I've been asked to give, for example, days of recollection to priests who've been falsely accused, or to listen to those who struggle with the other side of the issue, and work with victims, I mean, different things like that. After about 3 years, I thought I was dealing pretty well with it emotionally, but I realized at some point I wasn't, because my priest support group began to call me out and say, what's the matter? Everything's fine, you know? And they said, no, you know, we've noticed this and this, and you seem to be sad, or your face seems to be taut, or you even sound like you had a bit of depression. And I finally started listening to what they were saying, and I began to examine myself and realize that, you know, I hate to admit it, but they're right. That this darkness in the church, and that's just one level, I mean, you don't want to hear all the other garbage, but that was just weighing me down really, really heavy. And it was then that I said, I need to listen to my own wisdom and create a ritual, but I didn't know what to do. I knew it needed to be more than a lamentation. So I waited until I was visiting some friends over in Australia, and I decided I'm ready, and now is the time and place. And the reason I chose Australia was Australia has suffered even more than we have in this country. I don't know if you've done any reading about the church there, but percentage-wise, there are only 23 million people in the whole country. And Catholics are a large percentage, but they're down less than 20% of Catholics now practicing. And this is less than a generation. And the percentage of clergy abuse over there is much higher than it is here, much higher. And the bishops there have done the same thing the bishops here have done. It hasn't backfired. And what that is, a lot of denial and covering up and all that. Well, finally, the secular government stepped in and demanded a Royal High Commission investigation. So now it's taken it to the next level where it's not going to be pretty. The fallout has already happened. So anyways, just to give you why I went over there. So I went over there, and mentioned my own pain and suffering to these friends, and I told them what I wanted to do. And said, well, can we do it with you? I said, okay. So we went to out in the midst of nature, and we did tapping into the Judeo-Christian practice of lamentation, that I would call out what was in my soul about what angered me or hurt me or saddened me or depressed me. And I'd start that way. It's like a sentence completion. You know, I'm angry that. I'm sad that. You know, I'm hurt that. I'm confused by. Just calling it out into the cosmos. And then I was done, and my friends would go. It'd be like it's wonderful Greek Athenian choir going back and forth. And whoever was speaking, the other part would just say amen. Just acknowledge you've been heard. Okay, so back and forth. The central symbol I chose, this is the part that I don't share with most audiences, was a ceramic chalice. And when I'd finished, I felt like I'd been purged of everything that I could say in words. I knew I needed a symbol that would say it all. And so I put the chalice down in a rock, and I grabbed another large rock, and I smashed the chalice to smithereens. And I got to tell you, as a priest, that was scary. Absolutely scary. The central symbol for a priest. But when I did it, it was like something inside of me just exploded with recognition, saying, yes, that's how I feel. That's how I feel, that the beauty and goodness and holiness of priesthood has been shattered. And there's this darkness that was pervading in my soul. And that was a symbol that spoke to all of that, just that ritual breaking of it. And then I wept. And when I finished, I took all the pieces of the chalice and I buried it. And I walked away. And you know, that sadness and depression that I had before is gone. It hasn't come back. And I can continue to minister in this area. Because now I know it was a celebration of truth, upholding both ends, the goodness and beauty and holiness and giftedness of priesthood, what it can be, and yet what's happening right now. And to bring in the admission of shadow and the destruction and misunderstanding and abuse of power and authority and all that. So yeah, that really opened up compassion for me in a deeper way. I thought I knew compassion in that area. It wasn't until the ritual. It was like, I got it now.
You inspired me, Father Jim, to share something that I've never shared publicly. When you spoke about your art, about the art and meditation, several years after my husband died and after my family, we're having families and having all kinds of things, I felt tremendous pressure in my life, and the spirituality wasn't working for me, and I was more in touch with my demons. So I took a year off to meditate and see what my life was really all about. And doing that, I went through this incredible experience of daily doing little rituals and became aware of nature everywhere around me, speaking to me. At the end of it, I had an experience that on some level would have been called a breakdown. I called it a breakthrough. Yeah. And I experienced compassion for myself. And I had a poem come to me that I'd like to share.
Yeah, by all means.
And I called this poem The Self.
Yeah.
And it was one that was addressed to God. For you it deemed to fall the task of helping to remove the mask, revealing there a cavern deep that love and pain have carved and steeped. Signs of moisture on the wall give hint of stream or waterfall. Weakened walls and parched dark earth gave hint of slowly giving birth. But lest cracks be widened and destroyed, a simple truth just meant for joy. A moment's pause, a widened breach, and all was calm. My soul had reached.
Beautiful. I'd like to think that a beautiful poem came out of a reflection, not only on your pain, but out of your meditative practice. Blaise Pascal once said that so much violence happens because we do not sit for at least 30 minutes a day in silence. So however way you meditate or contemplate, that certainly is a wonderful, tried and true, traditional way of growing compassion for self. And obviously reaches out to others. So thank you.
May we get your thoughts on the event that happened just the evening before Good Friday in the framework of compassion? In other words, that wonderful washing of the feet scene. Does that play into this too?
It sure does. Thank you. Thanks, Tom. You know, the gift about the way that John tells the story, Evangelist John, if you look at the way it's lined up, it's very powerful. Remember the washing of the feet? Okay. Who did the washing of the feet? Jesus did. Okay. Who taught Jesus to wash the feet? Do you remember? It's right there in the scripture. A public sinner. A woman. She represented two marginalized aspects of society. So, someone on the outside, Jesus brought on the inside. So picture this scene. Here's Jesus and his buddies. We'll make this very contemporary. Jesus and his buddies. The supper's been prepared. The apostles are well aware of how this is going to go because they've done this since they were little boys. Okay? But Jesus decides he wants them to remember this occurrence. And so he introduces some changes into this very traditional way of praying. Okay? These religious individuals who know this particular ceremony backwards and forwards must have just been, had their socks blown off. Because the first thing he does is he goes around and washes his apostles' feet. That is left for a servant or slave to do. Never, never was it done by the host or someone in the family. Okay? And it was done as a sign of hospitality. But he goes around, he saves Peter for last, and of course Peter doesn't want to do it. He's always the guy who puts his foot in his mouth. And Peter is one of these all or nothing type of men. All right? And sure enough, we hear it again. Well, Master, then not just my feet, my hands, my head, my whole body. But Jesus, speaking of the symbolic meaning here, it's so important, he says, you don't need to wash your whole body. In other words, I want you to see and experience what it's like when you receive into your heart the missing parts of your humanity, the missing parts of our company. Okay? That when you do that, look what happens. Look what happens. How you're moved, how you're uncomfortable, but you become transformed. Okay? If that's not enough, he gets the famous words called the Barakah, giving thanks to God, and he blesses the bread and the wine. And he waits till the third pouring, the third going around, and he says those famous words of the Eucharistic blessing, take and eat, take and drink. This is my body, this is my blood. Now what he does here is so powerful. He's saying, I give you myself as nourishment. It's not just creation, it's not our religious beliefs, but it's me. It's the vibrancy of this relationship. That if you open yourself up to the nourishment within and between all parts of you, then you will recognize your divine nature. You'll recognize who you are. And then the world will never be the same. And when that's over, he leaves. And he walks out and goes through this whole thing in a matter of weeks. But they never, ever forget. It took them many, many years to meditate upon this, to begin to get the depth of it. And yes, it's true, depending upon which Christian tradition you come from, is that what's happened is many of us have sanitized this. We've forgotten this. We've forgotten some of the sub-categories of these rituals. And I must tell you, as a ritual elder, they're no longer rituals. They're liturgical rites. You have to do it this way and this way and this way. If you've ever been to a community that's a little bit more progressive, they open up the symbols in a way that just hammers you. And it just skewers you right there. It's like, wow, I can't run from this. Okay? There's a starkness about it. And yet it's a liberating thing. So thank you, Tom, for the opportunity. It's a powerful symbol of the banquet. Because when you read the scriptures, you'll see the Christian Hebrew scriptures, you'll see that the most common symbol for eternal life is a wedding banquet. Okay? And guess what? That means there's male and female there, all in equal proportion and equal identity. But so to come to that and to use, to frame that against what Jesus did with pure genius, because he knew they'd remember it, they wouldn't forget. Thank you. All right. My pleasure. Thanks. Thank you.